From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Every generation has that signature event, that moment when the nation holds its collective breath and wonders, is everything going to be okay? Pearl Harbor, the Kennedy assassination, 9/11 are a few of those moments. Another is the 1992 Los Angeles riots.
South Central Los Angeles was under siege today. Fires, rioting, looting, and always an air of anger at the police.
These people are angry. They have every right to be.
The city erupted after four white police officers were acquitted of the violent beating of a black motorist named Rodney King. Everyone had seen the sickening video that was taken from a terrace balcony. In the past few years, we've seen more videos of violent confrontations between the police and minorities, especially black men. This hour On Point, 25 years after the LA riots and in the wake of Ferguson and more, can we all get along? You can join us on air or online. Do you remember when that verdict came down in the Rodney King case? Were you shocked? Was it what you feared, expected? Do you remember the first time you saw the video of his beating? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me this hour from Los Angeles, Pat Morrison, columnist at the Los Angeles Times. In 1992, she was part of the reporting team who won a Pulitzer Prize for the coverage of the riots. She interviewed Rodney King several times. Pat Morrison, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Hello, Jane.
So take us back to that day in 1991. Remind us what happened to Rodney King.
What happened to Rodney King in 1991 was that his car, his Hyundai, going more than 100 miles an hour, was stopped by the CHP. This was a stop that was later joined by the Los Angeles Police Department. And as he was out of his car on the ground, the police began beating him to keep him on the ground. He said he stood up, he thought about running, but he was back on the ground. He couldn't go anywhere. And a man who just had a new video camera was standing on a balcony not far away and videotaped it. And when this videotape played the next day on television stations in Los Angeles and later across the country, there were African Americans in Los Angeles in particular who said, "See, we told you this happened all the time. Now you will believe us." It was a shocking thing to see our police department doing that.
Days after he was beaten by the police, here is 25-year-old Rodney King showing his injuries to reporters.
After the first three good licks with one, you know, one with that, with the shocker, and the next with the billy club across the face, I was scared. I was scared for my life.
You know, it's one of those moments where you remember where you were and what you were doing when you saw it. I remember I was a young reporter sitting in an edit bay. You still remember the feeling of that moment. Do you remember where you were and what you were doing?
It was in the morning, turning on the local television news, and this video, which didn't even play at the top of the news show, as I recall, was played first there and then over and over again. It became the meme of the early 90s here in Los Angeles, and it became a symbol for a lot of people of what was wrong with policing in Los Angeles. We had just gone through an economic crisis. Our first black mayor was in the last year of his 20 years in office. We were at the cusp of something big, and this was it.
So take us through the sequence of events after the beating of Rodney King and the officers who faced trial.
We had the beating of Rodney King, and within a couple of weeks, people don't bring this up very often, we had the shooting death of a girl named Latasha Harlins, black girl going to a Korean store. The Korean store owner thought she was going to steal a bottle of juice. She had the money in her hand, and she shot Latasha Harlins in the back of the head. The woman who shot her was given a suspended sentence, and this angered the black community further because there were a lot of Korean merchants in South Los Angeles, and people thought they were being taken advantage of. Then, in April 1992, in a trial in Simi Valley, a different county, the trial was moved. This was a largely white population, a largely white jury. The four officers were acquitted. People who were disgusted by the beating were also disgusted by the acquittal, and then disgusted by the violence that ensued. People could not believe the officers had not been convicted of what we had thought we had all seen.
So then take us to the moment when those verdicts came down.
We were watching here in the newsroom, and I remember my sense of astonishment. It was the same kind of gasp that you got 5 years later when O.J. Simpson was acquitted. People looked around the newsroom. I caught the eye of a black colleague, and she shook her head and said, now you get it. Now you get it. And within, I'd say, an hour, people were gathering in front of the police headquarters a few blocks from the L.A. Times. They moved to City Hall. They moved over to the L.A. Times. They started banging on the windows of the first floor. We could see them. Our editor went out to talk to them. One of our reporters, my colleague who'd been a combat veteran in Vietnam, went out to interview some of the protesters. One of them held a gun to his head. He said, dude, I'm just telling your story. It was a frightening, alarming situation, and it escalated very quickly.
Right, to riots over a period of 5-6 days, left more than 50 people dead, more than 2,000 injured, about 1,000 buildings destroyed in Los Angeles, estimated damage over $1 billion. Here's a clip from a reporter for Channel 2 Midtown News back in 1992. A fire was set in Midtown near a restaurant called Wild Man Pizza.
This is spreading so rapidly in it. I almost think there's gas or something because it just seems to be feeding this fire. This is the largest one I've seen so far today, the one that I've covered. I don't know. It just seems to be feeding awfully rapidly. And, Carl, don't get too close there now. Like I said, we can't see them right here, but looters are going around the back of the shopping center. They have just been driving their cars up, loading things up, and driving off.
And here's the sound of a reporter talking to a looter outside a Koreatown during the L.A. riots.
What did you get?
Shoes.
Shoes?
Yeah.
Where do you live?
Right here.
Why did you do this?
I don't know, because it's free.
Because it's free?
Yeah.
Don't you know it's wrong?
Nah.
You don't care?
I don't care.
So talk to us first about the riots, and then we'll talk about the looting that occurred afterwards.
The initial rioting was political. It was about the Rodney King verdicts, the acquittal of the officers. It was about the Los Angeles Police Department, which was a quasi-military organization and had been since after the Second World War. This is a very big city with a very small police department, and the emphasis for years had been put on simply suppressing and keeping down crime, almost whatever the cost. We'd seen the Watts riots. As far as many people were concerned, little had changed about policing since the Watts riots. But this had a broader impact, partly because people had seen the mistreatment, had seen the abuse. The rioting broke out in South Los Angeles, very close to where the Watts riots began, but pretty soon it spread. As you heard, it spread to Koreatown. It started moving toward above the freeway, which is kind of a demarcation of South Los Angeles. People got really alarmed. Store owners closed their stores. A friend told me that a neighbor ran over to his house saying, do you guys need a shotgun? In this case, someone far away from what was going on. But I think we were frightened at our own capacity for violence. Just as we've been angry at the verdicts, we were frightened at what was happening around us.
So the riots and the looting that ensued, I watched an interview that you did at that time with a roundtable of young people from Los Angeles. You spoke with an African-American youth minister from an AME church saying that what started as pent-up rage and a cry for justice turned into opportunists taking advantage of a situation. And so I'm curious, how did the African-American community respond generally to that part of the story?
You had people like Chip Murray, who was the pastor of First AME Church, the biggest African, oldest, I think, African-American church here. Mayor Tom Bradley was there as well, saying, whatever happened with the acquittals, we can still seek justice, but this is not the way to do it. And yet a lot of people did say, hey, great opportunity. Look, here we are. We can loot this store. Rodney King himself told me that he was watching from his house, and he thought that he would put on dreadlocks and a wig and go down and see what he could do and talk to people about this. But the opportunity was too tempting for some people. And yet one of the more poignant images of this is a man pushing a cart past a burning store, and the cart, the shopping cart, is full of diapers, is full of disposable diapers. Mm. And so you had that sense that the area had been neglected for so long. It had been overlooked. It had been taken advantage of for so long that here was an opportunity for redress, even though it meant criminality and theft.
Here's from that interview I mentioned in 1992, the interview you did at KCET. This is Shelley Henderson, a student at Occidental College, said she didn't support the riots or the looting, but that the people had valid reason to be out there.
people have lost their faith in the system, as we can see in the streets of L.A. There's a total lack of faith for the system because it seems that the system only works for certain individuals.
Lack of faith in the system, Patton Morrison, I mean, there were many who remembered the Watts riots of 65, as you say, right? They didn't want this toll again in their community, but it was happening.
And they understood that the community would be suffering long after the fires were put out, that not only would stores be closed, it would be harder for them to live their daily lives, but stores would be less inclined to open up there because of it. But what she was saying about justice not working for everybody is exactly the takeaway for a lot of people from the verdict. And even though later you saw federal court convictions of these officers, people thought, if you can see it before your very eyes and it still doesn't make a difference, what chance do we have? What did happen is that the city charter was changed, policing was changed because we had a federal consent decree of the kind that Jeff Sessions now evidently doesn't want to put in place. The Christopher Commission, led by the former Secretary of State Warren Christopher, instituted changes in how policing is done in Los Angeles. That was something good that came out of it. But that is something, too, that we're still struggling with.
You got to know Rodney King over the years. You interviewed him, had dinner with him often. Here he is in an interview you did with him in 2012, speaking about his legacy.
I left something for my country to always think about after I'm dead and gone. Can we all just get along? And hopefully we won't even have to, hopefully one day we won't even have to say that. We'll just be getting along.
Can't we all just get along? We remember that. We'll talk more about that after the break. Pat Morrison is my guest, longtime columnist and reporter for the Los Angeles Times. She covered the LA riots and was part of the reporting team that won a Pulitzer Prize for that. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. Much more after this break. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. And that is sound from protesters outside the Los Angeles County Metropolitan Courthouse after the Rodney King trial verdict in 1992. 25 years after the LA riots, we are taking stock of race relations in this country and relationships between the police and minority communities. You can join the conversation. Do you see parallels between Rodney King and what happened in Ferguson, in Baltimore, in Staten Island? Have you been out there protesting? Are you being heard? We're speaking this hour with Pat Morrison, columnist at the Los Angeles Times. She covered the LA riots in 1992 and interviewed Rodney King several times. Joining me now from Washington, Jeff Begays, justice and homeland security correspondent for CBS News. His new book is Black and Blue, Inside the Divide Between the Police and Black America. Jeff Begays, welcome to On Point. So great to have you.
Hi, Jane.
So what do you remember about Rodney King and the LA riots? What were the emotions of that time for you?
Well, just how it exposed this rift. And as you know, Jane, that's something that we're seeing again, or really that we've seen over the last 3-4 years with Ferguson, Baltimore. We have seen what has happened in Chicago with rising crime there in predominantly African-American neighborhoods. And so certainly looking back on that period in history, it reminds me of what many Americans are reliving now.
What has changed in terms of policing in America from Rodney King 25 years ago to what we're seeing now? Michael Brown, Freddie Gray, you know, Eric Gardner, the list goes on.
Well, it does go on, and the policies have changed. Certainly, there's been a lot of reform in policing. Technology has helped in policing over the last several years with the introduction of body cameras. But still, some of the underlying problems that lead to these rifts between communities of color and police, those still exist. And it was interesting listening to some of the footage from the Rodney King riots and this talk of feeling disenfranchised. There are a lot of people in communities of color who still feel the same way, and that's what I discovered as I carried out these interviews for this book, both talking to police and people in the community. I wanted to rip the Band-Aid off, if you will, and get to the heart of the issue and have people speak openly about what they think is the problem, because it still exists all these years after Rodney King.
So as a correspondent at CBS and also for your book, as you say, you've been talking to many police chiefs around the country. Here is an example of a couple of those. This is Charles McLellan, police chief of Houston, talking about police bias.
Well, if you're a police officer and you work in certain neighborhoods, certain communities, and the people that you are arresting look a certain way, behave a certain way, it's easy for someone to get stereotyped.
And here's Ed Flynn, police chief for the city of Milwaukee, saying that police officers are working in violent settings.
The leading cause of death for a young black man in America is homicidal violence. That's the environment urban policing is taking place in. It's not a question of making assumptions about folks.
So, Jeff Begays, give us a sense, 25 years after Rodney King, what these police chiefs are telling you about their jobs in the communities that they serve.
What they're saying is that their jobs are still getting tougher. And more is being piled on their backs. I went to Chicago and spent some time there as this crime problem that was growing there started to get national headlines. And I spoke with the head of the Fraternal Order of Police, Dean Angelo, who told me, and he was quite blunt in what he was saying. And he said that police are confronting more than just crime. There are social issues that police cannot handle alone. And quoting here, he said, "We can't fix your addiction. We can't cure your psychosis. But everyone wants us to do everything now because everything is related to crime. And the people that are on the streets end up at the wrong end of a police-involved shooting." So he was blunt in his assessment, saying that police have to deal with so much. They are on the front lines of so many social issues, and it falls on them to help. And it is overwhelming, and it speaks to the fact that their jobs are getting tougher.
Well, it speaks also to the fact, are we asking too much of them?
Well, I think if you spoke with rank and file police officers who are running from call to call, they will say yes, that these cities are putting too much on them. And now with the Trump administration cracking down on illegal immigration, that is falling in some ways in their laps as well. And that's why you have some local police departments pushing back, because so much of what they do relies on having this trust between community and police. And what we see is this breakdown in this trust. The more that is piled up on their backs, the more pressure police officers are under to deliver, and that creates this friction with the community.
I've got a long line of listeners who want to get in here. Let me get to Aaron first from Detroit, Michigan. Glad you called, Aaron. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I am a 63-year-old black male American. I want to make three quick observations.
Okay.
So I'll speak quickly.
Mm-hmm.
The first one, when it happened, I remember explicitly I was in the hospital. I'd had some trouble with some blood clots in my legs, and I was in a two-bed hospital room. The gentleman on the other side was a Caucasian male, middle-aged, maybe a few years older than me, probably in his 40s or late 30s, and he had a visitor, a couple of visitors. I had a visitor. The curtain was closed. We were looking at it on the news, and the comments from the other side were, and I had a visitor, and we were looking at it, and they were seeing it as Rodney King was resisting and causing the police to beat him. They were actually seeing it like that, and I could tell from their comments that that's how they saw it. And me and my guests were looking confused at how could you see a man being beaten this way as being the problem. But that's one perspective. The reason I mention my age is because I was a young man or a child in the 60s when the police were doing the same types of things, and it caused the rise of the Black Panther Party and some of the protests and some of the rioting back then.
Mm-hmm.
And now we've come all the way almost full circle through all of those years, and it has never stopped. It has continued. These excuses about how tough the job is doesn't wash because it's too despairingly one-sided. But what I want to say is that I don't believe that there should be room in the streets for black people to protest, because all the people who claim to be liberal whites and Christians and all of this, they should be out in the streets protesting. But we say that Black Lives Matter, and it's called a hate group.
Aaron, I hear you, and I'm glad you called. I especially appreciate the different perspectives that you mentioned that you heard that day during that time, Jeff Begays. It brings me to the perspective that you have. You have a very interesting perspective on this whole thing. You come from a family of activists. You have deep roots in Birmingham, Alabama. You grew up in Connecticut in a very different right. kind of world, right? Really. So I'm just curious, growing up, what the message was that you got from your family about all of this.
Well, Jane, as you noted, my parents grew up in the Deep South, Birmingham and Montgomery, Alabama, during the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And so they were in the struggle, and that's what they will tell you, for civil rights. They marched, they protested, they did very well in business, moved the family not only to Connecticut, but we lived all over the world as well. And so I've had a different perspective. But what the one lesson that my one of the lessons that my parents always reminded me is of what it was like to be black in the South, the colored only fountains. And so I grew up with that. It is in my blood. However, as a journalist, I've over the last 25 years covered law enforcement. And so I've been able to see both sides. And that's why I wanted to write this book, because there are people on both sides who want to see change and have been moving in that direction. But the key for them, and I think this is true of both sides, is coming to an understanding that there are different viewpoints, and how do you merge the two in such a way that you save lives on both sides?
So that background, I'm curious how that background instructs your coverage. You were in Ferguson after the Michael Brown shooting, and I wonder what surprised you about what you heard there from the police, from the black community.
Well, you hear the different views, and it's always been there. You know, it has been there. It was there before Rodney King. It was there before Ferguson, Baltimore. But you have these incidents that bring out this lack of trust between community and police. You have the flashpoints that create these conflicts. And over the last 3 years, we've certainly seen those conflicts grow into this national debate. And that debate has moved police departments to change tactics, to reform, to increase training, to increase transparency, and that has been a positive. I think most police chiefs in this country believe that that is something that is positive. But now we have a new administration that has come in and that has sent a different message than what the Obama administration sent. And we're still trying to figure out, well, how will this change policing, perhaps in the opposite direction. And so there is a lot of change. There is a lot of reform underway. But the question is, how will the Trump era, as Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, refers to it as, how will that impact this debate?
Pat Morrison, jump back in here. Talk about Los Angeles today, 25 years after Rodney King, after the riots. How do you see it?
Los Angeles is a city that's still reckoning with the damage from that, not really just the physical damage, although a third of those deaths that you cited, Jane, have not been solved, the deaths from the riots. What we're coming to terms with is the changes in the police department, the changes in policing, the changes in the demographics of Los Angeles as well. Los Angeles has never been a black-white city, as many cities in the East are. And so we're coming to terms with how our population is changing. And we watch Izelle Ford, we watch Eric Garner, we watch Michael Brown and think, what would happen here? We've had an increase in police shootings, fatal shootings of young black people here, and we ask, how are we going to deal with this? But we were there first. We had the consent decree. We had the Christopher Commission. So we scared ourselves straight, if you want to use that term. We're not exactly there yet, not by a long shot, but we realized that what was happening needed to be remedied insofar as we could.
I went to Los Angeles as a network correspondent for ABC just a couple of years after the LA riots, and it was still so raw. The city was still recovering, as you say, still on edge in so many ways. And I don't think you can overstate how the Rodney King incident changed Los Angeles forever, right? I mean, and I'm curious, Pat Morrison, how you tell this story to a generation that didn't live through it.
This is a generation that sees videotape all the time,
right,
that sees things videoed that were not visible before. And so to be able to explain that and say, this is a videotape that went viral even before the term existed and changed how people thought, how they felt, how they reacted. Even Rodney King, who was kind of a go-along, get-along guy. He had one very violent conviction in his past, but mostly he's a guy who worked to get enough money to go fishing and to drink some beer. He did not sense his appropriateness or his vastness. He was not a Rosa Parks. He felt that much was being thrust upon him. But he said, look, if it had to happen, maybe something will come out of this. You remember that 2 years after the riots, we had the Los Angeles earthquake. A year after that was the O.J. Simpson trial. Mm-hmm. The 90s were pretty tough for Los Angeles.
Right.
And so we had to look in the mirror more than we're accustomed to and say, who are we really and what are we doing with ourselves? What kind of city are we?
Jeff Begays, watching the Rodney King police beating on videotape, you have to remember it was a different time, as Pat says. No cable news. I mean, a man on his balcony with his camcorder, you know, delivering his video to a local TV station, which aired on network newscast that night. But that was a collective moment in time that Americans experience. It's so different now. Social media has changed everything.
It has, and it just makes those types of videos more widely available. You know, as Pat alluded to, we're seeing more of these videos, and part of the reason why is because they're spreading on social media. And they are exposing police tactics. But on the flip side, if you look at how body cameras have been introduced, which at first police did not want, we're finding that a lot of police officers now want the body cameras because they are showing a different side of policing. And so you're seeing that type of video spread as well, which shows police talking to suspects, trying to de-escalate situations, and it, in many cases, it has cleared police officers of wrongdoing. So in a lot of ways, what happened during those riots, what happened to Rodney King, that was a precursor of what was to come 20 or so years later. And so the real change here has been how social media has allowed these videos to spread and for more people to see them.
Let me play this clip. This is from an NPR interview. At the corner of Florence and Normandy, Karen Grigsby Bates speaking to Jimmy, who's 50 years old. He was in Los Angeles during the riots, and over the years he's had a few run-ins with police, he says. But he also says they're different now than they were 25 years ago.
The police, they respect you now because they're fearing their job.
Are you afraid of the police?
Because no.
Were you afraid in
92? I used to be. I'm not anymore.
So that's interesting, Pat Morrison. He sees a very distinct change.
And I think that part of what it was that Jeff was mentioning, the videotapes, both from the cops' point of view and from activists' point of view, have really pushed us to see that this was not a one-off. and to make us come to terms with the fact that this is daily life in a lot of communities, the policing community and urban communities. And it's a very important point to stress again and again when you look at how we change policies based on these realities.
Pat Morrison, longtime columnist for the Los Angeles Times, Jeff Begase, Justice and Homeland Security correspondent for CBS News with his new book, Black and Blue. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron. Blue Apron is the fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service you've heard about. Its mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to all. They support a more sustainable food system, set the highest standards for ingredients, and make it easy and fun to cook. You decide which recipes and how many meals you want each week. Change, pause, or cancel anytime. Learn more at blueapron.com/onpoint. Go now and get your first three meals free plus free shipping at blueapron.com/OP.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about policing today and the legacy of the Los Angeles riots. You can join the conversation. 25 years ago, Rodney King asked, "Can we all get along?" What's your answer today? We're speaking this hour with Jeff Begase, Justice and Homeland Security correspondent for CBS News. His new book is Black and Blue, Inside the Divide Between the Police and Black America. And with Pat Morrison, columnist for the Los Angeles Times, she shared a Pulitzer Prize for her reporting of the LA riots. Here's some sound protesters facing off with police in Ferguson, Missouri in August 2014 over the death of Michael Brown.
Hands up! Don't shoot! Hands up! Don't shoot! Hands up! Don't shoot! Hands up! Don't shoot!
And July 2016, a sniper gunned down five police officers in Dallas. At a press conference after the shooting, Dallas Police Chief David Brown described what the suspect told a hostage negotiator during the standoff.
He wanted to kill officers. And he expressed killing white people. He expressed killing white officers. He expressed anger for Black Lives Matter. None of that makes sense. None of that is a reason, a legitimate reason, to do harm to anyone.
Jeff Begase, being a police officer is not easy, obviously. What can you tell us, based on your research for your book, about the makeup of today's police force?
Well, the makeup has changed, and a lot of police forces across the country are having a difficult time recruiting new members, in part because if you look over the last 15 years, the country has been involved in wars, conflicts, and as a result of that, the pool of applicants has not been replenished, if you will. And that's just one of the reasons why police departments are having a hard time filling the ranks. The other problem that we're seeing is that images on TV have been working against police departments. And now,
in what way? What do you mean?
Well, just to see the video and to see the challenges that police officers are facing, and to see the unrest in communities and how it is aimed at police officers. And so, too, it is harder than ever for these police departments, these police chiefs to recruit. However, they are reaching out now in different ways because they realize that it is so important for them to recruit the best and the brightest and to fill their ranks because they are still being asked to do a lot. And you see in some cities, crime rising. And so being able to refill the ranks with young, energetic police officers, men and women, is a priority for departments all across this country right now.
Let's get William in here from Norfolk, Virginia. Hi, William. Glad you waited. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Hi, Jane. Thank you. My comment is, I heard what Mr. Begase said. And the real issue, though, is that he says police are getting a bad image on TV. The truth of the matter is that the educational system isn't educating people in general about what the laws are. The average person doesn't know what mere suspicion, probable cause, fruits of a crime are. The average police officer doesn't know that. You have to go to college to find that out. This is what the detectives know, but the average officer on the street doesn't know. Secondly, the real problem has been that police have now had to acknowledge that minorities have rights. The Fourth Amendment of the Constitution, the 14th Amendment, the Equal Protection Clause, prior to these incidences being made into documentaries and showing up on TV, the police never acknowledged that people had rights. Their job was to find any way to make a charge stick rather than give people credit for the rights that they have.
William, thank you very much. I'm going to let Jeff Begays respond to that, Jeff.
Well, I agree in a lot of ways with what he just said there. If you look at some of these Department of Justice investigations into police departments across the country, the theme, which is consistent throughout, is that a small portion typically of communities of color are being impacted in a negative way by police tactics. Take, for example, what happened in Baltimore in the Justice Department report there, which found that pedestrian stops were concentrated on a small portion of Baltimore residents. Police made roughly 44% of its stops in two small, predominantly African-American districts that contain only 11% of the population. And so what you found there was this negative impact, and in other cities, of harsh police tactics on certain communities of color, primarily African-American communities of color. And you saw that with zero tolerance policing and stop and frisk tactics, which it may have brought down crime, but it also drove a wedge between the community and police.
Pat Morrison?
In Los Angeles, one of the signal achievements since the Rodney King beating that the department points to is the demographics have changed substantially. More minorities, more women. I spoke to film director John Singleton last week about his riot documentary, and his quote was, "You no longer have what he said were white officers with porn mustaches patrolling minority neighborhoods. The department looks much more like the people it's patrolling." But Jeff's point is also well taken, that the broken windows idea ended up being used to abuse, to target, to go after people for, you know, it's inconsequential things that they said would get out of hand, when in fact all it did was, as he said, drive a wedge between police and the people they were supposed to be serving.
So we talk about the changes in the demographics of police forces, but Pat Morrison, talk about how institutions broadly have changed since Rodney King, since the LA riots. I mean, can you imagine a city falling into the kind of abyss where it is totally unprepared for protests, for riots? I mean, it seems police are out on the streets early now, which raises other issues, right?
They're out on the streets early before, in anticipation of these events, but they've also been out on the streets with community meetings. A lot of people who were on the other side, people who would have been holding protest signs 20 years ago, are now on police councils, on commissions, on organizations that talk to the police. And I think the biggest change has been, you start with Police Chief Bill Bratton and our current Chief Charlie Beck, is continuing to talk before you get to the shouting stage, before you get to the streets and the confrontation. And then before those things happen, the police are out there in a much less confrontational way, just talking to people rather than saying, all right, we're arresting you for jaywalking.
Pat, you mentioned Bill Bratton. Jeff Begays, I'm curious. The former New York City Police Commissioner, Bill Bratton, said that policing is a shared responsibility. And I'm curious, 25 years after Rodney King, what do you think he meant by that? And do you agree?
Based on what I've learned, not only covering law enforcement for 20-something years, but also based on my reporting in my book, it is. And that's in part why I wanted to make sure to talk to both sides in an open and blunt way. And so Commissioner Bratton was really an innovator in law enforcement. And one of the things that he did so well was reach out to communities of color before there was the unrest. He had a way of identifying problems acknowledging those problems in a public way and then trying to move forward together. And that is a key here, is acknowledging that there have been issues in the past. So how do we now move forward together to fix this? Because it benefits both sides if there is this open dialogue and this honesty about where the problem is and how to fix it. And he was very good at doing that. And you saw the proof with the numbers in New York, the crime numbers. Even after dispatching stop and frisk tactics, they were seeing record lows in crime. And so what he was able to do was prove that you don't have to have a zero tolerance policy. You take a more targeted approach and you can see the same results and still you don't create the type of divisions that led to some of the unrest in cities across America.
Let's get Pat.
At one point early in his tenure as police chief here, he had a community meeting. It was a very heated meeting. And people were yelling at him, control your cops. And he yelled back, control your kids. Maybe this is the kind of partnership in a different degree that we're talking about. But it has to be a partnership.
Let's go to Buffalo, New York. Patrick is on the line. Hi, Patrick. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. I'm a liberal white guy here. You know, your guest, first of all, said that Rodney King was no Rosa Parks. Wow. What an understatement. You know, those heroes who were beat by police officers during the 1960s civil rights movement, they were not acting like Rodney King. They were acting like Dr. Martin Luther King, a true hero. But what Rodney King did, he drove his car at 100 miles an hour through residential streets, and when it finally stopped, here's the part that is always missing, and it's a horrible thing that the cops beat him. Here's the part, though, that is always missing in the story that I would like your guest to address. Rodney King was not alone in his vehicle when he was traveling to 100 mile an hour through residential streets, endangering the lives of everybody. He had a passenger in his car. And when that car was finally surrounded and stopped by the police and the spotlight was above from the helicopter, the passenger got out as told by the police, and he was arrested peacefully. No struggle, no beating. He was handcuffed and taken to jail. Rodney King finally got out of the car, beat his own chest like a crazed person, looked up at the spotlight from the helicopter and started howling and beating his chest like he was on drugs. In fact, the LA police and other police departments saw that kind of behavior out of people who were on drugs. I can't name the drug at the time. This was 30 years ago.
But I get the idea, and I see the image, and I want Pat Morrison to respond to that. Patrick, thank you very much for the call. Pat?
I think a lot of people who weren't aware, as Jeff was saying, of policing tactics, the way things work, looked at this and thought, this is absolutely all terrible. What police looked at this, a lot of police looked at it and said that it was excessive, that the first blows were used to take Rodney King down and keep him down, but that it went beyond what was necessary. And so that point was one of the points, I believe, that was brought out in court, was where was the line of excess? Where was the line crossed? Not that the first blow was wrong, but that there were subsequent blows that were wrong. And so the caller has a point about how Rodney King behaved. He told me, I said, what was in your mind when you were trying to get up? He said, I just thought of, you know, I used to go over to that park over off the freeway, and I was just thinking maybe I could get over there.
He wrote about forgiveness of the officers, Rodney King did. Tell us about that and what ultimately happened to Rodney King.
Rodney King said that in a way he had to forgive because the only alternative to hating was being a victim. And that he was tired of that. And that in a way the conviction of the officers for violating his civil rights in a federal case was a kind of balance. And he said it just takes up too much energy in his life to keep going on and to keep hating the officers themselves. And about 5 weeks after I spent some time with him on the 20th anniversary of the riots, talking extensively, we went to dinner, we went to lunch, he died. He drowned in the swimming pool of a house whose down payment he made with some of the money he got in the legal settlement. And there were drugs in his system. There was PCP. There was alcohol. There was marijuana. He liked to sit and smoke marijuana and drink beer. But it was an early and sad and, in a way, inconsequential ending to a life that had had such consequence thrust upon it.
Jeff Begay's, Rodney King's famous phrase was, can't we all get along? You know, we all remember that. Years after that, years after the riots in Los Angeles, and now moving forward, after Ferguson, after Baltimore, after Staten Island, what do you say? What's the answer to that question? Can't we all just get along?
It's still a work in progress. We have seen over the last few years steps taken in the right direction. I think people on both sides will acknowledge that. More transparency, an effort to get police officers out of their police cruisers and into the communities, an effort on the part of people in the community to reach out to police officers in moments in their neighborhoods where they can talk about sports, something that they may have in common. But there is still a long way to go. And there are signs that the Trump administration doesn't agree with what the Obama administration did over the last 8 years in terms of consent decrees and trying to reform police departments. So that is still an unknown. Where does this administration go from here? We know that the Attorney General has tried to put a stop to some of these consent decrees. But I know in talking to police chiefs that many of them are moving forward. More training, more transparency in an effort to keep the dialogue going.
Pat Morrison, you get the last word here. Rodney King's famous phrase, can't we all get along, years after the riots and now? I mean, well, did he believe that everybody was getting along better before he passed?
He thought that things had changed because of what had happened to him. And that was something that made him happy. He told me he wanted to leave to President Obama the tie he wore when he made that statement. He did not know at the time, but he came to realize how important a statement it was. He turned down the script his attorney had given him, and he just spoke what he was thinking. And it came out haltingly, but that made it all the more passionate.
Pat Morrison, columnist at the Los Angeles Times, Pulitzer Prize winner, covered the L.A. riots, and here today to look back. Appreciate your time today, Pat. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jane.
And Jeff Begay of CBS News. His new book is Black and Blue, Inside the Divide Between the Police and Black America. So great to have you, Jeff. Thanks.
Thanks, Jane.
An important conversation. Listeners, thanks to you as well. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.